Sudan's civil war has just entered its fourth year. The violence affects some people differently than others.
This is a war that is being fought on the backs of women and girls.
I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. Today, that story from Sudan. And in Venezuela, a new law brings foreign investment to gold mines. People in many local communities rely on the dangerous work to make a living.
Hay niños también allí.
Even children, says this man.
Also, Ukraine's high-tech fighting, instead of sending humans to the front line. It's sending robots, says Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky.
Plus, is the future of international relations about hair?
That's all ahead today here on The World.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. Thank you for being here. A grim and chastening anniversary, that is how one UN official described today as the civil war in Sudan hits the three-year mark.
Tom Fletcher, the UN Undersecretary for Humanitarian Affairs, spoke at a conference in Berlin, a high-level meeting to raise money to help those affected by the conflict. He wasn't just talking about the humanitarian crisis stemming from the war. He also took the international community to task.
We must ask ourselves which statements were given a year ago that are similar to today's statements, and which statements do we risk giving in one more year, which are similar to today's?
We will look shortly at the situation on the ground in Sudan, but we begin with a closer look at what is behind the conflict. Alex Duvall directs the World Peace Foundation at Tufts University's Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy. I asked him to remind us what started this war.
So the immediate trigger was that there are two generals in Sudan, General Abdel Fattah al-Burhan, head of the Sudan Armed Forces, the regular army, and General Mohamed Hamdan Dagalo, who's known as Hemeti, head of a paramilitary known as the Rapid Support Forces that grew out of the Janjaweed militia, notorious for genocidal massacre in Darfur some 20 years ago. And the two had mounted a coup together. They were partners in crime. They overthrew a civilian government that was on track to hold elections and bring democracy to Sudan. But the two men fell out, and they fell out primarily over who would control the army. And Hemeti tried to launch a coup on this day 3 years ago. He failed and plunged Sudan into a war, which, even by the terrible standards of Sudan's wars, is the most terrible for well over 100 years. It's a war of mass displacement, famine, mass hunger, enormous depths of human suffering, mass rape, famine, etc., that has really brought the country to its knees.
Does one side have an upper hand right now?
Depending on which week we are in, one side has the upper hand. One side may be taking territory, shooting its drones and destroying a military convoy of the other, or capturing a garrison after having starved its inhabitants to the point of death. But if we look at the big picture, it is essentially a stalemate. Neither side can defeat the other.
You and I have talked before, and we've talked about the lack of international aid for Sudan, the lack of international pressure on the warring parties to stop this conflict. Why is this conflict so difficult to end?
Well, there's a lot of polarization within Sudan itself, which gets deeper and deeper. The longer the war goes on, the more atrocities there are. But a particular factor here is that there are regional powers arming either side. So on the one side, we have the United Arab Emirates, which is arming the RSF. They deny it, but I think everybody acknowledges that this is the truth. And on the other side, we have Egypt, Saudi Arabia, and a number of other countries that are arming the Sudan army. And for them, these Arab states, the amount of resources they devote to sustaining this war is small change. They're enormously wealthy. And that's what's made this particularly intractable.
And remind us what the UAE and the Saudis and the other backers on both sides of this conflict are getting out of that. Why are they arming each respective side in this war?
The UAE and Saudi are rivals for who will be the bigger player in the Middle East. And that includes the Red Sea, a very strategic waterway and its coastline, a very important piece of real estate.
The Red Sea is important here because Sudan borders the Red Sea and the UAE does not, right?
Yes. In addition, Sudan possesses some resources that the UAE in particular is very interested in. gold and land. And the UAE wants its investments in those two key commodities to be secured. Now, there have been efforts to try and close the gap between particularly the Saudis and the Emiratis by the United States, by Secretary of State Marco Rubio over the last year, on the grounds that if these two countries can agree not to fuel the war, then that's the beginning. And that certainly is, in principle, a good way of approaching it. It hasn't worked. And we will know today whether the latest effort is making progress. All those countries are meeting in Berlin, in Germany, to try and agree an aid package, a humanitarian truce, and the beginning of a political process.
That conference in Berlin that you mentioned, it does not include either of the warring parties here. Can you explain the rationale there? Is it because these international actors are really the power behind those forces?
That's absolutely correct. So the rationale was that if you try and bring both of the warring parties, one will object to the presence of the other. The big question now is, with all the disruption that's going on in the Middle East, with all the uncertainty, with the Saudis and the Emiratis facing the threat from Iran, facing the question of, do we any longer trust the United States to look after our interests? Will they come to the table to agree between themselves? Or will they be distracted by these other, for them, much bigger questions and simply not turn their attention to solving the Sudan disaster?
Alex Duvall is executive director of the World Peace Foundation at the Fletcher School. Now let's zero in on one aspect of life on the ground in Sudan, especially for women and girls: prevalent sexual violence. Stephanie Hoffman, based in Khartoum, oversees pediatric clinics for Doctors Without Borders. She told me sexual assault is being used to control people in this conflict.
It's really become a defining feature of this war, and we're talking about severe brutality, including gang rape, abductions, violence at gunpoint, often in front of their families. So in 2025, we treated more than 4,000 victims of sexual violence in all of Sudan. And in Tawila, as we were talking about before, in 1 month alone, we had more than 730 cases. So this is extremely widespread. And what we're seeing is only the tip of the iceberg. A lot of the cases are underreported, often because there's a lack of services available, but there's also an enormous stigma associated with sexual violence.
So probably few women who experience this are actually coming to get healthcare.
Absolutely, yeah. Because they're scared of the consequences if they do seek healthcare. And a lot of the time, healthcare is not available to them. It's not in every town that you can find a facility that is offering comprehensive sexual violence care.
Are both sides in this conflict perpetrating the sexual violence?
Yes, both sides of this conflict are perpetrating sexual violence. And based on the patients that we've had and reports that we've seen from other organizations, 60 to 90% of these sexual violence acts are being carried out by armed actors.
This sexual violence is widespread. Are there pockets where it is safe for women and girls right now in Sudan?
Yeah, there's areas that are safe now. In Khartoum, they're in a stage of recovery. The fighting was extremely intense here, and most of the population has fled. So there are areas of the country that had fighting previously, but the front lines are constantly changing. And throughout the past 3 years, the entire country has been affected. There's been no part of the country that has been spared in this war.
You know, it strikes me that it must be terrifying to be anyone on the front lines of this conflict, but maybe particularly women and girls. Do you have a sense of what it is like living with this on the ground right now in areas of active conflict?
I can't really put myself in the shoes of a Sudanese woman, but based on the patients we've seen and our Sudanese colleagues, I think that every single woman in Sudan is aware that at any point they theoretically could be a victim of sexual violence. This is a war that is being fought on the backs of women and girls. And as we've talked about, the cases that we've seen coming into our clinics are some of the worst cases that you could possibly imagine, things that most of the world could not imagine.
Really heinous violence is being committed by both warring parties here, both the RSF militia and the Sudanese armed forces working for the government. With MSF, you are working with the government, which is in control of Khartoum right now. How do you navigate working alongside one of the warring parties to try to provide health care to victims of both sides of this conflict?
Everywhere that we work in the world, we have to collaborate in some way with the authorities that are in place, whether these are official governments, whether these are alternative forces, whether these are armed forces, rebel groups. We don't have a choice but to collaborate in some sense in order to be able to carry out our activities successfully. If we weren't open and transparent about our activities, we wouldn't be able to have access to the population, which is the most important thing for us, is that we can have direct access to the population being affected by the conflict. So we are a completely independent organization, a transparent organization, and this allows us to intervene in some of these areas that are the most heavily hit by the conflict.
That was Stephanie Hoffman from Doctors Without Borders in Khartoum.
The crackdown on immigration is affecting a lot of American businesses, including ones that hire workers on the H-1B visa program. That visa allows immigrants in a number of professional fields to legally work in the U.S. They form a big part of the tech workforce here. Now, getting the H-1B visa takes time, skill, and luck, just like a video game. You might be able to guess where this is going. KQED's Azul Dahlstrom-Ekman has more from a recent gaming conference in San Francisco.
The game is called H-1B Life.
America, the big and beautiful country. But you need a visa. Be talented, big brain, build chips. Then you might get an H-1B visa.
Players take the role of an immigrant trying to get and maintain H-1B status. Playing on a smartphone, the top half of the screen has life scenarios, and the bottom half shows a series of choices.
We want to build a simulation, like a life simulation of people who are going through this process.
Allison Young is the founder of the game studio Reality Reload, which aims to explain reality through video games. Young immigrated to the United States from China, and she says the storylines in the game are drawn from around 20 interviews with H-1B applicants.
Since we're doing all these interviews, we realize the pain is very real.
Young says her video game aims to show the uncertainty of people's lives who are on H-1B status. In the virtual world, players succeed by maintaining four core attributes: intelligence, wealth, social support, and burnout rate. If any of these run out, it triggers a roll the dice feature where different gods decide players' fates.
The player usually the one who has the least power or say, but they are the one who have to play through. So that tension is something we want to focus on.
Every year, hundreds of thousands of people from around the world apply for the H-1B visa lottery. The number of selections is capped at 85,000. And if people are selected for the lottery, there are several more hoops to jump through, says Sophie Alcorn. She's an immigration lawyer who represents tech workers in Silicon Valley.
There's randomness, there's luck, there's skill, there's strategy, just like in a game.
Alcorn says H-1B rules have changed a lot over the last decade under several presidential administrations, but especially in the last year, as the Trump administration has introduced new rules. They include a $100,000 fee, criteria affecting the chances for lottery success, and limits on where people can get visa appointments.
Getting selected alone is a feat that some individuals spend years hoping to achieve. And many are disappointed and they are not able to successfully make it through and they have to leave even after putting down roots in this country.
The team behind the video game recently showcased its prototype during a game developers conference in San Francisco. Don Duke Dovden tried it out. He's a former H-1B recipient from China and now a U.S. citizen. He says the game is a little too accurate, calling it triggering.
It's a very long path and you sacrifice so much personal time, especially with your time with your family.
He says he didn't go home to see his parents for 10 years while he was pursuing citizenship. Software engineer Chris Chowdhury also played the game. He immigrated to San Francisco from Canada on a different work visa and says what the game does get right is the way it depicts immigration status as a series of choices.
When I meet other folks who are on a visa, it's like one of the first things people talk about, right? Because it kind of weighs into a lot of your other decisions.
Reality Reload, the creators of H-1B Life, plans to add more real-life stories to the game in upcoming updates. For The World, I'm Azul Dahlstrom-Ekman in San Francisco.
Just ahead on the show, All That Glimmers, new foreign access to gold in Venezuela. You're with The World. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Venezuela has already passed new laws to open its oil sector to foreign investment after decades of tight state control. Now it's doing the same with mining. As part of Venezuela's engagement with the Trump administration, the government in Caracas approved a sweeping law to allow foreign investors to develop mining projects. But mining in Venezuela already has ties to armed groups, illegal activity, and environmental damage. As we hear from The World's TBC Isaiah, it's not clear if the new law will change how the industry actually works.
To understand what's at stake, we need to look at southern Venezuela, a vast region known as the Orinoco Mining Arc. It covers about 12% of the country, an area roughly the size of Pennsylvania. Much of it is protected rainforest, home to indigenous communities and some of the most biodiverse ecosystems in the world, and major rivers crucial to provide electricity.
The Orinoco and the Caroní rivers are some of the most voluminous rivers in South America and in the world.
That's Cristina Fulmer, founder of the nonprofit SOS Orinoco. In 2018, she began investigating reports of illegal mining inside Canaima National Park, a UNESCO World Heritage Site, home to the famous Angel Falls. Using satellite imagery, her team found the protected area was being mined.
We were able to produce the first report that revealed that there were over 35 illegal mines within Canaima National Park. And with that, we kind of uncovered this horrific situation that we realized was happening all over southern Venezuela, not just Canaima.
Much of that expansion goes back to a government decree from 2016. With oil revenue falling, the government turned to mining, particularly gold, and it opened vast areas of the south to extraction.
All of a sudden, we start seeing that the military and civil authorities are partnering with illegal miners, with armed criminal groups, to control and exploit and open up mining areas, particularly in protected areas.
Today, large parts of the region are controlled by these groups. And for many people living there, mining has become one of the only ways to earn money. And even then, the prospects are difficult. I spoke with three miners from the Warao indigenous community who asked not to be named for safety reasons.
No es hambre, ya es miseria. Ya la gente, ¿cómo se llama? Ha dejado a veces la agricultura para irse a la mina.
He says many people have abandoned farming and turned to mining, and that desperation is being exploited. Armed groups recruit people from some of the poorest communities, including children and teenage boys, he says. People work in dangerous conditions. There are no salaries, one miner told me. It's all based on luck, going down 15, even 20 meters down, hoping to find gold, he says. Some work day and night, and most don't get to keep what they find.
Entre las mismas comunidades hay mucho dengue, mucho paludismo, mucha gripe y falta de atención.
Miners describe outbreaks of malaria, dengue fever, and other tropical diseases with little access to health care. The miner says women are sold to gang leaders and forced to do sex work. Fulmer's group SOS Orinoco has also documented similar abuses. Mining is also contaminating rivers and food sources. Mercury, which is widely used to extract gold, spreads through water and fish that is consumed by animals and humans, and it can cause serious neurological damage, especially in children. The government says opening mining to foreign companies will bring order, oversight, and jobs. And some miners hope that too.
Las expectativas también es que como es una van a entrar empresas privadas, eso también es empleo.
The expectation is that private companies could bring formal jobs, one of them told me. But some experts are skeptical. Mónica Martín, who leads Venezuela's main association of mining engineers, says the law does include some positive elements, like clearer rules and oversight.
En esas mejoras de seguridad, de algo de seguridad jurídica y reglas claras, hay aspectos positivos.
But even when it looks good on paper, she says it doesn't address a deeper problem.
Pues porque esta ley está hecha por las mismas personas que han estado durante 26 años en el gobierno.
The law is being created and implemented by the same people and institutions that allowed illegal mining to expand in the first place. And that, she says, raises serious questions about whether regulations will be enforced, and if doing so will lead to armed conflict. The government is hoping to attract foreign companies, especially American ones, but it's not clear how many are willing to take the risk.
We haven't seen any big mining companies actually come in. I mean, it's hard to go in there and actually make it operational.
Elias Ferrer runs Orinoco Research, a consultancy that advises investors on Venezuela. He's been organizing field trips to bring potential investors into the country.
It's going to take a very long time for investors to actually make their way in. And there's a bit of like a wait and see of how these new laws are going to be applied in practice.
The companies most likely to move first, he says, are those that already have some experience in Venezuela or those that are more risk tolerant. And many of them, he says, are not in the United States. For the world, I'm Tibisa Isea, Mexico City.
This is Austrian musician Manu de Lago, gently tapping the instrument he is known for, the handpan. It's something like a cousin to Trinidad's steel pan. With a handpan, you've got two metal half shells glued together that make distinctive dinging sounds when tapped.
They stand out on de Lago's latest album, Deuce. Deuce, of course, means two. This is not a solo album. De Lago brought in Brooklyn-based musician Max ZT. He uses small wooden mallets to play the strings on his hammer dulcimer.
Austria's de Lago and Max ZT met almost 10 years ago when de Lago was out on a U.S. tour backing Icelandic singer Björk. The two bonded over their desire to play lesser-known percussive instruments, and they were curious what would emerge if they played those instruments together. Fast forward to 2025, and they are ready to record this latest album, Deuce.
They hike to their studio, a 13th-century monastery in the Austrian Alps. The acoustics are perfect and take the delicate and meditative sounds coming from their instruments to another level.
You're with The World.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. As Ukraine defends itself against Russia, it's gotten a reputation for its ability to use drones in the air war. Well, this week, President Volodymyr Zelensky introduced robot soldiers to the ground war in a video that's now gone viral. The future is here on the battlefield, and Ukraine is creating it, says the wartime leader, standing in front of a line of small unmanned ground vehicles, or UGVs. He presents each one by name.
Ratel, Termit, Ardal, Rysh, Zmi.
Zelensky says the unmanned vehicles have completed 22,000 missions on Ukraine's front lines in 3 months. Then he makes a startling claim. He says that thanks to these ground robotic systems and drones, Ukraine, for the first time in the war, has captured a Russian position without any infantry. To find out more, we reached out to Arthur Holland Michel. He's a writer and researches AI and emerging technologies.
In Russia, Ukraine, there have been many, many cases of soldiers surrendering to aerial drones, which are, of course, much more common. But this is, of course, another step. Now we are seeing this proliferation of ground robots, which were very rare in the early years of the war and now are becoming rather common, if Zelensky's claims are to be believed.
So in the Zelensky video we just heard, it's a little hard to see what these ground systems look like behind him. But as we heard, he's naming them, so he's trying to give them some kind of human quality. Have you seen them, and can you describe what an UGV looks like?
They come in all sorts of shapes and sizes, but the most commonly used one, imagine a tank that has been shrunk down to maybe the size of, I don't know, maybe a small hatchback, perhaps even a little bit smaller, with a variety of weapons that can be put on top. So some of them might have a machine gun or a rocket launcher or a grenade launcher. Others have wheels, so they more look like remote control buggies that maybe you scale up, and they're all sort of green and very, very scary looking. I will say there's definitely a publicity element to that as well, that, you know, they're meant to be ferocious looking technology.
Yeah, I mean, at first you kind of see Wall-E, that Disney Pixar character, and then you realize it's got a gun and it's kind of threatening.
Yeah.
As for the capture and surrender on the battlefield, what would that have looked like? Can you describe the scene as you imagine it?
Yeah, so from all accounts of this one particular case, it was a combined assault force of ground robots and aerial drones. And so the people inside were probably facing a tremendous amount of fire on their position. They were probably aware of drones in the sky. They had figured out that they were essentially cornered. They had no escape route. And then a single ground robot, as we understand it, approached their position and had its gun or its weapon system trained on the opening to where they were hiding. And then they emerged, all three of them looking absolutely terrified from the position. One of them covered in blood. It's a really striking and alarming bit of footage. Again, we don't know if that's what Zelensky was referring to, but that's the sort of way that these systems have been used, although that is certainly a minority of the use cases for these robots. The majority of them are doing slightly more mundane tasks, like just ferrying petrol and supplies and food along the front lines.
So in this sort of battlefield capture, how much control would Ukrainian soldiers have had over the robotics? Like, how close to the front line would they have been with remote controls?
Ukraine says that these robots do have some autonomous functionalities, but from everything I've seen and all of the reporting, they still very much have a human in the loop. So there is a person probably maybe some dozens of kilometers away or perhaps even a little bit closer operating by remote control. If these robots do have any AI or autonomy, there may be some navigational capabilities and maybe some target tracking, but we're not talking about robots actually making kill decisions on their own. That's very, very difficult to do at ground level compared to, say, a drone in the sky.
Is that something that might evolve in the future?
Yes, of course. In all of these cases, across all the domains, air, ground, sea, there is a strong push to increase the autonomy of these systems. That's largely because the more autonomy you have, the less susceptible you are to the countermeasures. So Russia and other militaries are very sophisticated at jamming those remote control links between the human operator and the drone or the robot. So if you can have the robot operate on its own and find its way or find its target and only communicate with the human soldier sporadically, then it's much less susceptible. There may be some limits to that, though, and this is especially the case with ground robots, because it's actually very hard to get autonomy right on the ground. There are a lot of obstacles. It's a more complex environment to have to navigate compared to an aerial drone, where Ukraine and Russia are already using some pretty advanced autonomy, where the drone will maybe fly the last 1 or 2 miles with barely any human input before striking their target.
Of course, that's just clear air, and you're talking about challenges on the ground, like probably basic stuff like trees and gullies.
and mud and snow and some barbed wire. I mean, these machines can be stumped by all manner of obstacles. And that gets to this other point, which is for every measure in war, there is a very quick countermeasure. And so whenever something like this happens, there will be a response from Russia and vice versa. And so I wouldn't be surprised if we now start seeing Russians deploying some kind of countermeasure, perhaps not even a sophisticated one, to stump these ground robots in the same way that we've seen this sort of cat and mouse game play out in the sky, where we have drones punching into other drones, drones controlled by fiber optic cables, drones cutting the fiber optic cables. It is all happening in this very, very rapid and alarming cycle that doesn't really have a fixed endpoint. We don't really know where it's going.
Well, we'll have to see what Russia responds with. But I mean, just the announcement and development of this news, we know Putin is struggling to keep fresh soldiers involved in the war. And it now seems Ukrainian robots are able to beat Russian soldiers on the battlefield. What does this mean for Russian morale right now?
Ukraine has proven itself to be absolutely masterful at leveraging its technological prowess for publicity coups. This goes to, you know, everything from using small, cheap drone boats to take out a chunk of the Russian Black Sea fleet to all these videos of people, you know, being hunted down by drones. And now this is sort of another prong in that trident of drone-based publicity. I will say, though, that Russia has a fairly sophisticated ground program of its own, and it is expanding it very rapidly, and it is probably hoping to achieve a similar effect on its own side, which wouldn't be surprising because it's matched many of Ukraine's capabilities in other domains over the course of the war.
I'm speaking with technology writer Arthur Hollomichel about what looks like a historic shift in how wars are fought on the front line. We've been hearing a lot about Ukraine's advances in drone warfare, and you just mentioned Russia's own advances. But how far out front is either country when it comes to ground robotic systems?
Many countries have been developing ground robots for a very, very long time. But when you develop a new technology, you don't know if it works until you've actually deployed it in the heat of battle, which obviously not every country can do. And so that allows you to iterate in a way that you just can't, you know, in the lab in a peacetime scenario. So in that regard, Ukraine and Russia have probably learned some very, very valuable lessons for how to make these robots work and how to deploy them at scale and how to build them quickly that definitely puts them out in front, even though there are, of course, you know, big major militaries in Europe, the United States, China, that have ground robot programs of their own, but they just haven't proven themselves yet.
Well, none other than former CIA Director General David Petraeus recently said Ukraine is on track to become the most important military-industrial complex in the free world. Does that sound right to you?
If you narrow that down to drones, then yes, nobody is matching the drone production capacity of Ukraine right now. They produced several million last year. They're on track to produce about double that, so anywhere from sort of 6 to 7 million this year. Nobody's getting anywhere close to those numbers.
Yeah, elaborate on that a bit, because Ukraine has recently made lucrative robotic deals with the Mideast, right?
Yes, indeed. We're talking about multi-billion dollar deals, some of them, I think, lasting as long as 10 years. I think the years ahead will prove to be, yeah, very, very lucrative for the Ukrainian drone industry moving forward.
Arthur, you've not only looked at the mechanics of these technological advances in robotic warfare, you've also looked at the ethical issues involved. What concerns you most?
Look, war is fundamentally a human endeavor. The ethics and morals of war are intended to constrain the actions of humans. And the more that you remove the human from the loop, the more that you create a distance between the human who makes a decision and the target or the victim of that decision, the more that scaffold of law and morality begins to erode. These systems can now be produced so inexpensively and at such scale that it's actually changing the calculus of going to war and of staying at war. You can actually put your enemy at risk for a few thousand dollars a pop. That is a new economics of warfare that lowers the threshold for the decision to go to war. And it also changes the calculus in terms of sustaining your war effort and deciding whether to continue to go to war. So it's not going to give us a more peaceful geopolitical environment. In fact, my sense is it'll do quite the opposite. And of course, that is tremendously problematic. That's something we really need to think about.
So if these methods of waging war prove effective in the long run, how quickly do you think this robotic technology is likely to spread?
Incredibly quickly. We're now seeing a step function. We're now seeing countries across the board announcing that they have plans in the next couple of years to produce not hundreds of drones or even thousands of drones, but tens of thousands and hundreds of thousands. So it's pretty grim to say it, but the floodgates really do seem to be open. The barrier to entry is essentially non-existent. None of the components are particularly hard to get one's hands on. None of the manufacturing techniques are particularly sophisticated or difficult to master. And for any military that has some amount of resources, you can produce a tremendous amount of material in not a very long amount of time. You don't even have to build a significant industrial base.
Countries getting these, and what about non-state actors? Does that worry you?
Absolutely. If anything, non-state actors are some of the pioneers in low-cost, homemade or DIY drone technologies. So in a not-so-funny way, we've actually seen a trickle-up of those techniques into militaries. But now I think we'll see the cycle repeat where there'll be a trickle-down. And yeah, we will see non-state groups using these systems to sow terror, achieve all the goals that one can achieve with, you know, other traditional weapon systems, but on perhaps a vaster scale or with greater range or with more of a publicity element, which is, of course, always a consideration as well.
Arthur, do you see any efforts to rein in or establish some guardrails for some of this technology?
There's been a long-standing effort at the United Nations to limit a very narrow slice of these technologies, which is fully autonomous weapon systems that can make kill decisions without any human input. There are some export control efforts, but they're fairly limited. There's not a lot on the horizon that's going to pull it back, but that calculus could change very quickly. I mean, all it takes is one, you know, mass harm incident to occur in a place where regulations can be spurred along, and that might change. But it's also very difficult just because of how accessible these technologies are. It's hard to control.
Arthur Holland-Michel is a writer who researches AI and emerging technologies.
It seems that Spain and Turkey are growing closer. It started last month when Spain came out strongly against the war in Iran. Turkey, which borders Iran, does not want a conflict so close to home. So Turks have been praising Spain's position and offering what may seem like an odd thank you gift to Spanish men. Hair. Yes, human hair. From Barcelona, the world's Jerry Haddon explains.
In a soccer stadium in central Turkey in March, the crowds cheered on their respective teams, but then they came together to celebrate Spain. Olé, they yell in unison. You can hear the faint sound of a band playing, a traditional Spanish paso doble. It was an odd moment, maybe, but from a geopolitical standpoint, the fans were cheering on their side. Spain, like Turkey, opposes Israel and the U.S.'s war on Iran. Juan Luis Manfredi, a professor at the University of Castilla-La Mancha in Spain, calls their positions a strategic convergence.
Spain opposes any type of military escalation because you will never know what is going to happen. And the Spanish public opinion is reluctant to any type of military action.
For Turkey, he says, the stakes of a regional war are even higher.
I mean, energy shocks, migration, warfares will be horrible, especially for Turkey.
Both countries, Manfredi points out, are members of the NATO military alliance. For Turkey to remain neutral, it needs Europe to do the same. Spain's early opposition helped shape that very position for the EU's bloc of 27 nations. Brussels is calling for a negotiated settlement, and the EU won't join the fight.
Onların anlayacağı şekilde söyleyelim isteriz. Gracias por estar en el lado.
Praise for Spain's leadership came swiftly through official Turkish channels. This TV newscaster went live with her thanks, first in Turkish, then in Spanish, saying, "Thanks for being on the right side of history, Spain. Thanks for representing the common sense of humanity." As a token of that thanks, Turkey is also offering something pretty enticing for Spanish men. "Bring us your bald," they're saying. "We'll send them home with hair, or at least hair implants." This ad from a company called Turkish Hair Center offers 60% discounts for Spaniards, wavy locks as a way of saying thanks. And they mean it. In the airport in Istanbul, there's a big video poster showing a bald guy. When he passes his hands over his head, hair magically appears, along with a big smile. Also appearing in airports, droves of Spanish men, their pates shining under the bright lights. When they leave...
No.
Well, one person on YouTube found it funny. On an airport escalator are at least five men with partially bandaged heads, their scalps red from the treatment and dotted with newly transplanted hairs of hope. And it isn't just Spaniards coming. Hair implants are a huge business in Turkey, generating some $2 billion a year. Last year, 1 million men came for the procedure. People have started calling Turkish Airlines Turkish Hairlines, and the gags keep coming. In this TikTok sketch from the Irish Daily, a skeptical customs agent studies a guy's passport. In his photo, he's bald.
"That looks nothing like you, mate. Where is it you're coming back from?"
"Turkey."
When you finally see the man, he's got more hair than the three Bee Gees brothers combined. "Fair enough," says the agent, waving him through. But no one's suggesting the war in Iran isn't a serious matter. Juan Luis Manfredi says Spain's Pedro Sánchez will surely continue to speak out.
"Internationally, Pedro Sánchez is looking for a progressive counter-voice with a Western branch, if you want. So, and Turkey is supporting that idea. It's good for Turkey to have this counter-voice, which is not coming from Merz, Germany. It's not coming from Macron."
Emmanuel Macron is France's president. So for the time being, Spain and Turkey will support each other. And online, we'll likely see even more memes of Spaniards transformed from Mr. Clean into George Clooney. For The World, I'm Jerry Haddon, Barcelona.
It is not just hair that has implications for global issues. Up next, what wastewater at airports can tell us. That story just ahead. You're listening to The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. As spring emerges in the Northern Hemisphere, we leave behind the winter flu season. But there are always viruses that we humans are good at passing to one another, including new variants of COVID. About a year ago, I went to the airport, not to get on a plane, but for science. During the height of the COVID pandemic, testing wastewater was a fairly new way to track the spread of the virus. Since then, that kind of testing has expanded around the globe, including testing wastewater from airplanes at select sentinel sites strategically located across the globe. The idea is that this could help detect new pathogens faster. Alessandro Vespignani is a professor at Northeastern University working on this here in Boston. I met up with him on location to hear how it works. We are here at Boston's International Airport. We're standing near the TSA security line where people are going through, about to get on their airplanes. Tell me why you think planes that land at a place like this have an advantage for identifying the spread of viruses early.
Well, you know, we, the people, are the spreader of diseases. We are also the carrier of disease. And so if you go back with your memory to the early days of COVID-19, one of the problems is that we thought, okay, we don't have people coming from China because we closed the border. There is no travel from there. While instead, the cases and the infections were flying into the US from many other countries, and there were a lot of undetected spreading. So we want really to not be blindsided the next time, and we want to have a way to anticipate when a pathogen is introduced in a country. And the introduction points are airports. This is where millions of people that can carry diseases can get into the country.
So tell me how this works. A plane lands here, as they're doing, every few minutes. Then what happens so you can understand what's going on with the wastewater there?
Think about an infected person with a pathogen that boards a plane. During the flight, that person goes to the bathroom and leaves a trace of the pathogen in the sewer of the plane. When the plane lands, somebody is going to take a sample of the sewage water that then is discharged and cleaned from the airplane and then sent to a lab. This lab does genomic screening and can get all the list of pathogens that are in that sample and eventually signal the introduction of something that is a threat. When you have a hit, at that point you can say, look, on this flight or at this airport, we got the introduction of that pathogen. Now other sentinels across the world do the same work. And if you see different hits in different sentinel airports, you can start to triangulate, identify where the virus general pathogens comes from, and the characteristic of that pathogen.
So why airplanes specifically, the wastewater from airplanes and not airports or another physical location?
In an airplane, you can identify not just that the pathogen is coming into the country, but also, okay, from which route? You can go back and test the sample that you have accumulated in time, and eventually, if there is something completely new, understand when it got first in the country. The best way to envision this approach is to have international collaborations.
How has wastewater monitoring for viruses evolved since the early days of the pandemic? Has it become more widespread? And are countries monitoring for other things besides COVID?
Well, it was not used that much before COVID. Instead, you know, COVID was a kind of battleground testing of those technologies that worked in the end. And so environmental wastewater is now used in several countries to monitor the prevalence and incidence of the disease. And it has been tested the generalization to other pathogens like the flu and other possible threats, health threats to the population.
I imagine wastewater testing is expensive. Is there a concern about there being a budget for this kind of thing, for the expansion of this into a real program or cuts to existing wastewater surveillance that the CDC is already doing?
These are expensive programs scientifically, but, you know, this is like buying your insurance toward another pandemic event. And believe me, these are little fraction in terms of what we spend for many, many other things. So this is a very good investment if we want to have a country that is better prepared, monitoring, and better aware of all the possible pathogen threats across the world. We want to have monitoring systems that are timely, ready, and can tell us, okay, there is a situation, and we can have actionable insight on what to do.
Are we not there yet? Have we not learned that lesson from the pandemic?
The CDC is building the equivalent of a national weather forecast for pathogens to try to have reliable forecast and outlook on what could be the health threats for our country. But there is need of political will. There is need of resources. There is need of the population buying into the idea. And so we need to be prepared.
Alex, thank you so much for this conversation and for coming out to the airport with us.
Thank you very much.
Alessandro Vespignani is a professor at Northeastern University.
After soundly defeating former leader Viktor Orban in Sunday's election in Hungary, Peter Modjar, in one of his first acts as new prime minister, today vowed to shut down the country's state broadcaster, M1, while speaking with one of the station's hosts.
After chiding the station for not letting him on during the entire election process, Magyar went on to say that his TISA party will end the state TV's factory of lies. He vowed to encourage independent professional media organizations. In heated but civil exchanges, the host pushed back.
Here, she reminded Magyar that shutting down the station without changing the country's media law would be illegal. With a laugh, Magyar rattled off the list of illegal things he claims the station's news falsification director has done, and how the official and other members of former Prime Minister Viktor Orban's inner circle got rich, while average Hungarians can't afford food or heating their homes. Magyar said accusing his party of doing something illegal would be like a shoplifter shouting at a police officer, "Hey, don't steal."
The World is produced by GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris studio in Boston and from the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. Join us right back here tomorrow.
The World is supported by the Carnegie Corporation of New York, working to reduce political polarization through philanthropic support for education, democracy, and peace. More information at carnegie.org. By the Lumina Foundation, committed to a fair, universal system for learning beyond high school that offers every American the chance for a better life. LuminaFoundation.org. By the PRX Ambassador Council, whose members include Renee Vacchio Albi, Roman Mars, the Kelsen Foundation, and the Ken and Lucy Lehman family. The World's theme music is composed by Ned Porter. The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX.